Welcome to the latest edition of the Closing Conditions podcast. I'm John Crabb, Managing Editor of IFLR. We have an excellent guest this week, someone who's been working with IFLR and Practice Insight for many years, and who anyone involved in European financial systems or financial reform will surely know. Nicolas Veron is Senior Fellow at both Bruegel, a Brussels-based economic policy think tank, and the Peterson Institute for International Economics, where he hosts the Financial Statements virtual event series. As a regular contributor to IFLR, Nicolas is one of those sources you can count on for an insightful opinion on almost any area of global financial regulatory initiatives, with well-researched opinions on a multitude of topics. Previous roles include being a corporate advisor to France's Labour Minister, a board member at DTCC, and as a CFO at an internet company in the late 90s. There's little doubt that today's conversation with Nicolas will offer great insight into the financial markets. Please enjoy the episode.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Nicolas. It's a pleasure to have you on. I'm sure.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, I'm sure everyone's going to really enjoy what you have to say. We've met for lunch and dinner a fair and a few times, and it's always been fascinating. So I think you've always been very vocal in your discussions of Brexit. I think when we've spoken in the past, you've always managed to keep a partisan approach to that without taking too many sides. But now that the divorce has happened and it appears the EU and the UK are going to see further diversion in the financial markets, how do you see the new landscape looking in Europe?
Well, it's still very fuzzy because to make the metaphor, the dust has not settled. The good news is that Brexit, in the sense of the UK leaving the EU, not just the EU, but the single market, has happened without many accidents. So the key moment, of course, was January 1st, 2021, and this was very orderly. And I think it must be said again and again that this required a lot of hard work from authorities, but also and maybe primarily from financial market participants. So there was a lot of work and energy that went into this smooth transition. Part of that work has been probably appropriately about delaying some of the deadlines and the authorities providing exemptions in different forms so that the transition would not be too abrupt. And of course, one of these is equivalence for clearing services, and there's a lot of media chatter about that. But perhaps more importantly is for banks, for example, the fact that the ECB as a supervisor has allowed banks to deploy their Brexit plans gradually and not to have everything in place on a kind of steady state organization that would satisfy the Eurozone regulators, the ECB, on a long-term basis as early as January 1. Now, the flip side of that, of course, is that it can become a comfortable position for the banks not to execute the Brexit plans fully, and that includes, of course, relocation of some activity, and keep that as a status quo. So the ECB, even so it's difficult to observe from outside because that activity by its nature is not held in the public view, but the ECB has been tightening the screws, asking banks to report on where they have their desks and where they have different activities. And there has been a little bit of media coverage of that, but not much, a little bit in May. So all this is ongoing, difficult to observe. But what that means as a bottom line is that we're not yet at the end of that transition. It's still happening as we speak. And it's difficult to say to which extent most of it has already happened or most of it maybe is still to come. Maybe I should stop there because there are so many moving pieces, but the main point is that we are in this kind of suspended situation, which means that maybe the Brexit transition will never end, but it certainly hasn't ended yet.
So talking about the moving pieces, so what about the UK specifically? Obviously, you're kind of on the EU side, but what changes to the financial system do you expect the United Kingdom will make in the coming years without the quote-unquote shackles of Brussels?
Well, I'm not sure I'm on the EU side. Right now, I'm in Washington, D.C., so closer to London than Brussels. And as you know, I work for the Peterson Institute here in Washington, which doesn't have a dog in that fight in a way, and also at Bruegel, which is supported both by UK government and Bank of England, among others, and of course by a number of governments and institutions inside the EU, but not the EU institutions themselves, with the exception of the European Investment Bank, I think. So you know, even Bruegel, certainly in London, is perceived as a Brussels thing, and that's where it has its offices, but we're not wedded to an EU perspective. I think it's clear that the UK and specifically the City of London will remain the largest financial center for the foreseeable future, unless something really unforeseen happens, just because it's been so dominant for the last two or more decades. And it's so much larger than any other financial center. So nobody has an interest in an abrupt transition where everything would change very quickly. And if things are to change gradually, that means that it will be a long time before London gets superseded, if that happens at all, by any competing financial center in the European Union. Now, I think it's also true that there is... the EU is much larger than the UK. It's an attractor for a number of activities. That's where the clients are to a large extent. And it's much more, it's less, to state the obvious, it's less easy for UK-based firms to serve a number of EU clients as an offshore financial center than in an onshore position, as was the case when the UK was in the single market. So it is inevitable, even irrespective of any specific initiatives by EU authorities, that there will be a relocation or a reshuffling of the geographical footprint of a number of large firms, so that they serve EU clients closer to where those clients are. And I think that's inevitable. So the question, which is more difficult, is how that affects global markets that are served out of London. And of course, here, the derivatives market comes front and center, and also debate about clearing, because here there are effects of clustering, which are particularly powerful and which the EU cannot probably replicate from scratch. So the EU will not displace London, where London really serves a global market with a very powerful economies of scale. So the long story short is London has already lost and probably will lose more activity linked to serving EU clients. And we don't really understand the linkages and, you know, the kind of bandwagon effects that come with this. So the extent of the loss of activity is difficult to state. Of course, it's not a static space. So London may gain other activities, or the EU may gain other activities. And here there is real competition between different financial centers, and including different financial centers inside the EU. We'll probably come at that. But it puts London in a very defensive position, I think, with the main concern to preserve as much as possible of the existing activity, given that gaining more activity is probably going to be more difficult, given the loss of competitive positions that is inherent in Brexit. This shift from onshore to offshore vis-a-vis the EU obviously makes it a comparatively less attractive place to do financial business.
So, taking then from your DC position, or Europe, or even the UK, is there any specific part of the divorce that you're most concerned about, kind of vis-a-vis financial regulation, anything that's causing you trouble?
As I said, it's been very orderly, and I don't expect instability going forward. I think if you look at the debate on clearing, it's very clear, no pun intended, that the authorities, both in the EU and in the UK, want to avoid something too abrupt. So that's why the EU is taking its time. There's almost a year until the end of the current equivalence recognition. And to be honest, I have no idea what the Commission will decide. I don't know more than anybody else, but I will not be surprised if the Commission further extends that deadline just because it wants any transition, if there is one, to happen in terms of relocation, to be well prepared. This is a critical infrastructure. It has many financial stability implications. The European Commission had initially said it would announce some, at least, tentative decision in September. Now it delays that, and the more time goes, the more implausible it is that they would force firms to change their clearing location on a short notice, precisely because there is this generally shared imperative of avoiding instability. So I think that's a defining feature of the situation. Now, concern is not just about instability. It also has to be about the efficiency of the system. And basically, if the financial system serves the economy well, the efficiency of capital allocation is very difficult to measure. And it's not clear that the pre-Brexit situation, where so much was happening in London, serving the entire EU market, was optimal in terms of proximity to clients. So it's plausible that at least on some market segments, and then we can go into a lot of detail, you would have more efficiency in capital allocation if you have a more distributed situation inside the EU, where you have a critical mass of activity in several financial centers, obviously, you know, Frankfurt, Paris, Amsterdam, the usual suspects, but also Milan, Madrid, Dublin, of course. I mean, if all these centers raise their game, leveraging the opportunities that Brexit represents for them in terms of location of financial activity, it may turn out to be an improvement in the quality of financial intermediation in Europe, or it may also lead to more fragmentation and basically less liquidity and a premium in the cost of finance. So I think it's far too early to have a sense of that, because it will depend on policy initiatives. Obviously, banking union was an improvement inside the EU in terms of reaping the synergies of the single market and getting closer to a real single market in finance. But banking union is an unfinished project. There are key aspects of it that haven't been done. Deposit insurance comes to mind, but it's not the only one. There's been a lot of rhetoric about capital markets union for 7 years now, but not much has been done concretely to advance that vision. So I think we discussed the UK very briefly. For the EU, whether Brexit turns out to be a disaster, a lost opportunity, or actually something that is useful or leveraged in a useful way remains entirely to be seen. It's too early to have a clear picture of that.
So you just mentioned the banking union, which was something I was meaning to ask about. Do you still think that the need for banking union is as stark as it was when the idea first appeared and as a kind of complement to the capital markets union? And do you think this will ever be finished?
The need is definitely there. And I think it corresponds to the changes that we have seen in the European Union since, right? I mean, there are maybe two changes worth mentioning. One is Brexit itself, which means that the Eurozone is even more dominant in EU finance than it was before. Just to give orders of magnitude, before Brexit with the UK in, the Eurozone represented about 2/3 of total banking assets in the EU. Now that the UK is out, it's about 9/10. So the banking union gets closer and closer, because it's a Eurozone project, to banking policy integration on the scale of the entire single market. And indeed, we're seeing some countries joining the banking union as part of their path towards joining the euro. That's the case for Bulgaria and Croatia, which have become part of the banking union last year and will adopt the euro in 2023 or 2024. And that may be the case of other member states. For example, I don't think it will be a major surprise if Romania goes along the same path a bit later in the decade. Now, the other part of your question was whether the completion of the banking union will happen. And as you know, there are big political bottlenecks here about the whole issue of risk sharing and particularly deposit insurance that kind of crystallizes it in countries like Germany, but also in other pieces of the jigsaw, like the full operationalization of the bail-in concept, as we have seen in a number of bank failure cases since 2017, is not there. I mean, at this point, there are plenty of escape hatches that allow member states to avoid bail-in because clearly they prefer, they have a revealed preference for bailout. And we've seen that in Italy, we've seen that in Germany with NordLB, we've seen that in other member states. So making bail-in a reality, which I think everybody's paying rhetorical lip service to, but not when it comes to actual cases, I think remains an essential piece of completing the banking union. And another essential piece, which maybe gets less media coverage, but is no less fundamental, is the whole issue of concentrated sovereign exposures and especially domestic sovereign exposures in the balance sheet of banks. As you know, most banks in the Eurozone have a predominant exposure to their home country sovereign. And that reinforces the notorious doom loop, the bank sovereign vicious circle that the banking union is designed to mitigate. And that can be addressed with proper regulation, with things like concentration charges, so regulatory penalties when you have concentrated domestic sovereign exposures or sovereign exposures in general, incentives to diversify within the Eurozone. But there is huge resistance against that from especially national debt management offices, which in some countries are very influential within the government machinery. And therefore, it's a difficult step to make. So my view, for what it's worth, is that it's completely possible to complete the banking union. You don't need a treaty change. It's actually less difficult politically than what has already been achieved with the single supervisory mechanism. But it's still difficult, and we're not in a crisis now. So the preference is to procrastinate. And that's what we've seen in the last few years.
Well, that sounds promising. Let's move on from straight Brexit and all of the auspices of that now and talk about COVID-19 and the impact it's had on the financial sector. So how do you feel that the European financial industry has been impacted by the pandemic, and how well did it do in dealing with that?
I think it did very well. And the cliche is that the banks have been part of the solution, not of the problem this time. But I think this itself was made possible by the work that had been done in the previous years, especially in terms of strengthening the balance sheet of banks, in terms of the implementation of Basel III, higher capital ratios, higher quality of capital, and also, even so it's far from finished, trying to mitigate the worst practices of excessive low risk weighting of some assets. So that's a whole debate about the completion of Basel III, output floors. It's a very active legislative debate in the EU. Maybe we'll come back to it. I think the UK is committed to faithful implementation of that last bit of Basel III, which is good. And I hope the EU will do the same. By the way, I don't think we have seen any indication so far of a race to the bottom in terms of the regulatory competition between the UK and the EU. That may come in the future, but so far, especially when it comes to banking regulation, we've seen the Bank of England in particular advocating sound and credible standards for and the adoption of this last bit of Basel III is one example of that. So essentially, I would say the COVID-19 sequence has been a spectacular vindication of Basel III. And then the financial system has been protected from loss of market access or liquidity episodes by extraordinary public intervention, which I think was very successful, including the intervention of central banks. And in the case of the EU, something really game-changing that was the announcement of the Next Generation EU plan, not just because that provides stimulus and new investment, but because it really changes the way markets look at the EU financial architecture. As you know, Next Generation EU is a temporary one-off program, but it's the first time that the EU borrows money directly from the market on such a scale, and it kind of establishes EU debt, issued and managed by the European Commission as a new reference in the marketplace as a safe asset, if you will, which is being issued now in significant quantities and will be for a couple of years before the program tapers off. So, of course, the big question here is whether this is really a one-off or whether it will be repeated in future. And this has a lot of political, legal, and financial dimensions. But the mere fact that to address this emergency of COVID-19, the response has involved a large-scale EU level borrowing and financing, I think has radically changed the way a number of market participants look at the Eurozone in particular and at the EU more generally. And you see that in the sovereign spreads, Italy, of course, being the one most watched, where spread compression through the COVID-19 episode beyond the first few weeks has been truly extraordinary and very stable again after the first few weeks of instability. So the Italian spreads over 10-year German sovereign debt have been extremely stable for almost a year, around 100 basis points, which frankly is really low when you look at the Italian debt position and also structural difficulties in that economy. So that's been very stabilizing, very successful. Whether it's thanks to the financial sector, I would say it's more a political process, but in which the financial sector has been enlisted in what I think has been by and large a very apt and successful response to the exogenous shock of the pandemic.
So obviously it sounds like the regulatory safeguards that were put in place over the last few years to protect the economy in times of crisis have worked in Europe, at least.
I would say so. I think Basel III obviously has worked. I would say also banking union has worked, because if you look at the regulatory relief that was granted to banks early in the crisis in terms of, you know, ability to use some buffers and also the prohibition of dividends, and these decisions were made very quickly. And if we had 27 supervisors having to form a consensus inside the EU without the centralization within the ECB that we have with banking union, I mean, we don't know the counterfactual, but it's very possible given what we saw, especially in 2007, 2008, in terms of inefficient decision making, that you wouldn't have had that ability to make very quick, strong adjustments to the policy stance in order to mitigate the shock of COVID-19 lockdown. So I think if you take those two big pieces, Basel III, even with the non-compliant bits in EU transposition, and the single supervisory mechanism, they've played out very well in the pandemic. Then you have, you know, all kinds of discussions on other aspects. And obviously in the US, the treasuries market is a big concern, but inside the EU and including the UK for that matter, I think what we've seen is basically the reforms of the last decade or so playing out broadly as designed, doing the jobs they were supposed to do, with no major gaps that were identified through this crisis. I mean, the striking thing is that the COVID-19 episode has not triggered a debate about new urgent financial regulatory reform, which to me means that the system has worked pretty well.
So do you expect that when the crisis, if it ever ends, the pandemic ever ends, do you envisage further reform to kind of shore things up based on what has been learned over the last year and a half?
I mean, of course, there's been a big debate on whether there would be a lot of non-performing loans when the extraordinary support measures are withdrawn. And to many people's surprise, this doesn't appear to be the case on a very massive scale. Of course, there will be more NPLs when support measures are phased out. But for example, a lot of debt moratoria have already been phased out in many countries. And actually, it has worked much better and more smoothly than frankly, I had anticipated. And the same is true, I think, for a number of subsidies or debt guarantee programs, which were massive, were probably necessary, again, played their role, are being withdrawn, and we don't see, the proverbial tsunami of NPLs coming up. So a lot depends on the situation with the virus itself, of course, and if we have new variants, and who knows what the next steps will be. But at this point, with the vaccine having been developed so incredibly quickly, and with a global research effort really supporting vaccination, even so it works much better in the rich world than in the poorer countries. But even in poorer countries, there, I think, it would have been a brave assumption in mid-2020 that vaccine deployment would exist and be effective as it currently is across around the world so quickly after the emergence of the virus itself. So I'm veering a bit off track here, but just to say that a lot of things have worked better than what could be feared in the early months of the crisis. At this point, I don't see that the COVID-19 crisis in the area of financial regulation specifically has revealed vulnerabilities in the systems that require specific additional reform, at least in the EU and the UK. Again, the US may have some other specific issues, but we're not yet out of crisis, so it's too early to jump to conclusions.
Okay, let's move on again to a new topic. So the EU's been working on bolstering its anti-money laundering reform. How crucial do you see this task, and where do you see it going in the next year or two?
Oh, I think it's absolutely critical, and especially what emerged from 2018 with, ABLV and Danske Bank and ING and what have you. We've seen that the anti-money laundering system in Europe was basically not working at all, and that the flaws in the system were structural and linked to the fact that we had, to put the long story short, a single market with fragmented enforcement of anti-money laundering policy, and that couldn't work because it led to a systematic race to the bottom, regulatory arbitrage and concentration of harmful activity in the weakest links of the system. So the only credible response to that is policy centralization. It's exactly what happened with banking prudential policy with the inception of banking union in 2012. And it's what's happening now again with anti-money laundering supervision, which I think is a very good thing. So as you've seen, the European Commission has published a pretty ambitious proposal in July, including the creation of a European anti-money laundering authority, which Ursula von der Leyen highlighted today in her State of the Union speech. And this is probably going to happen. It's going to take a few years to be operational. But at this point, I and most observers expect that the legislative process will bring this project to fruition in the next 12 to 18 months in a way that is that represents a massive step forward in terms of building a credible AML infrastructure in the European Union. Will it be perfect? No. First, it will take a number of years to be fully operational, and even then, there will probably be more challenges. But it's a very important step, and one that I think whose importance cannot be overestimated.
So, with the COP26 coming up, when the whole world will be watching Glasgow and the world's leaders, how important do you think international legal and regulatory cooperation is in the push towards a proper sustainable financial environment?
Well, that's a big debate on, how important is sustainable finance in reaching the objectives of sustainable development. And as you know, there are different opinions there. I think there's a lot of experimentation, and especially in the investment space, private sector initiatives or hybrid initiatives like what the International Financial Reporting Standards Foundation is trying to do with their new sustainability-related standard-setting body, which will be put in place, I think, in the next few months. I think all this is fascinating, promising. How much it will contribute to resolving the challenges of global warming compared with other perhaps blunter initiatives such as putting a price on carbon emissions, I think is still up to for debate, and I don't pretend to have an edge on that debate. I've been observing it, but it's evolving very, very quickly. I think at this point, sustainable finance has not really developed yet into something completely compelling. There's a lot of controversy about greenwashing, about measurement issues. That's why I think what the IFRS Foundation is doing is important, because we really need standards for measurements and recognition and, you know, auditability of all that, which currently don't really exist or not at a sufficient level of quality. I think finance will contribute to the effort against global warming, but I think the central front of that effort is in things like carbon taxation, how to redistribute the burden that comes with it, very important issues of fairness and inequality in that matter, that in my home country of France, we've felt very vividly with the Yellow Vest movement. So lots of challenges beyond finance. And I think the role of finance in addressing those challenges should, of course, not be neglected, but also not overestimated.
So one region that I'm sure will come up countless times during the event is Africa, where the need for sustainable finance is perhaps more stark than other continents, and that the push to provide adequate infrastructure must meet green criteria to be sustainable. What steps do you think can be taken to ensure that the continuous financial and physical generation of Africa is done in a sustainable manner, and whose responsibility do you think that is?
Well, to be honest, I think it's really a matter, to a large extent, of public investment and official financing, a bit like we've seen with the vaccine, right? I mean, in a way, there is a parallel between the situation we have with the vaccine, in which as long as not everybody is vaccinated, everybody is at risk, right? Because what we want is eradication of the virus, ultimately, even so it will take a long time. And because otherwise it will continue to mutate and come back to even the rich countries in forms that are more contagious and more dangerous. But basically, there is an enlightened self-interest of the rich countries that they should finance the vaccination of the entire world, including in poor countries such as many in Africa, in their own interest and not just for humanitarian purposes. And I think we have exactly the similar pattern with differences when it comes to fighting global warming. If we just build a greener infrastructure in the rich world, it will not be enough. It has to be everywhere. And poor countries have a very legitimate argument that the wealth of the rich world has been built on intensive use of energy resources, and they shouldn't be deprived of the opportunity of development just for the sake of fighting climate change, or if that's the case, as the burden of that should be shared, including by the richer countries. So I think this is the biggest issue at stake. Of course, the financial sector should serve that burden sharing, but ultimately it's about official budgetary efforts and transnational transfers, frankly, which may be painted one way or another, but ultimately have to happen. I think this inside the European Union has been the big lesson of Next Generation EU. I mean, the taboos that have been broken by several taboos have been broken, including, as I mentioned, EU level debt issuance on a large scale. But perhaps the most impressive one is that countries like Germany and the so-called frugal have explicitly accepted the principle of cross-border transfers in order to address a shock like COVID-19. And I think ultimately to fight climate change and to have Africa and other poorer parts of the world contribute to that effort, we will need more transfer of burden. The rich countries paying for the poor ones on a scale that we've never seen before.
Okay, Nicholas, that was all the questions I prepared. So, I mean, if you have any other topics you'd like to discuss or anything else you'd like to raise, then please feel free to do so.
No, I think we covered a lot of ground.
Yeah, we certainly did. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I hope and just listeners enjoy listening as much as I have.